Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone. It's another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. We're so glad that you could join us, and I'm really, really thrilled to be talking about, well, let's go this way. It's not that I'm thrilled at the topic that we're going to take today, other than I think it's going to be fascinating and interesting, but it does emerge out of what I think is really a pretty sad situation. What we're going to do tonight is we're going to reflect on Mormonism and especially Polynesian Mormon aspects that might have taken part in the story of Manti Te'o, the All-American Heisman Trophy runner-up, amazing middle linebacker for Notre Dame's football team. And part of the story that made it so interesting and fascinating throughout this senior season of his was that in early September, the story broke that his grandmother and his girlfriend both passed away on the same day. And then a couple of days later, he played an amazing football game, bunch of tackles, they beat a rival, and it kind of launched Notre Dame into their undefeated season right up until when they lost in the national championship game. And so there was this piece of the story that was, you know, what we love to hear is the underdog, the person overcoming adversity, they're pouring their grief into exceptional abilities and accomplishments. And so that was a big piece of the story, though obviously tackles and you know, athletic performance were a larger piece of why he became such a prominent football player. But then it broke just a week ago. We're recording this on Tuesday night, and so it was a week ago tomorrow that a story came out that showed that this girlfriend had never existed. That all the evidence at this point points towards his having been duped into thinking that he was having a relationship with a real person when indeed it was somebody instead who had concocted elaborate hoax. And he fell in love online with a woman who turned out to not be real. And it all sort of unraveled, and it's been dominating the news lately. And so we're going to assume that everyone has heard of the story, and maybe other pieces of it will come out as we talk tonight. But I've gathered a panel of great friends and insightful Mormon watchers and people with really good backgrounds in different areas to talk about the Te'o story, but to really use it more to illuminate aspects of Mormon culture, Mormon thought, Mormon community, and things like that that sort of feed into a culture in which somebody might be naive enough to fall for a hoax like this, to ignore red flags because of a trusting nature or whatever. So we're gonna use this as a way to talk about Mormonism, and then also especially to add in the piece of Pacific Islander culture that Manti was from. With a name like Manti, we can guess he's also LDS. That was a piece of the story I forgot to mention earlier. So we have this Latter-day Saint Mormon going to Catholic Notre Dame, and that's a neat story in and of itself. And so we've got one of our guests with us is going to help us with the Polynesian cultural pieces. Quick disclaimer here to begin with, too. As we talk today, there's going to be, you know, things that come up about Mormonism that we're going to maybe laugh at, or we're going to kind of roll our eyes at, and we're going to, you know, say some things that, or we'll just discuss some things that are not ideal. And every community has that, and we all recognize that. And in Mormon Matters, we talk freely about different things in this. But again, I just wanted to put a disclaimer in case we forget as we go that everybody on this panel is Latter-day Saint. We're all active. We all enjoy the community. We're all glad, but there's a big integral part of our lives, and any critiques or whatever are fully given out of a constructive agenda on our part. Let me have our panelists introduce themselves. Jennifer Finlayson Fife, you're our biggest veteran of the podcast before. We've had you on four or five times. Would you remind everybody a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I live in Chicago. I grew up in Burlington, Vermont, in a large family of eight children, and grew up LDS and went to BYU and then on to Boston College, where I got my PhD in counseling psychology. And I now am married and have three kids and live and work in a suburb of Chicago primarily as a marriage therapist, and work with individuals and couples, mostly around issues around sexuality. But, you know, the whole gamut of human experience comes into my office. So yeah, that's who I am.
Absolutely. And when we get into trusting nature and, you know, those kinds of things, you're really going to be so helpful for us. So thank you for welcome to the show, and thanks for being on again.
Thank you.
Stephen Carter, we're welcoming you back for, I'm guessing, third time, maybe fourth time.
Yeah, I think this is my third time out.
Great. Would you tell us a little bit about you?
Yeah, I come from a family of nine children. So hopefully our other panelist has come from a family of 10 children. But I grew up in Utah. I'm a Utah boy. I got an MFA in fiction, and that made me a ton of money. So I decided to go off and get a PhD in narrative studies. And I did that in Alaska, where I studied how first-year teachers in rural Alaska tell stories. It was a really interesting project. And now I am the editor at Sunstone Magazine.
Indeed you are. And you're married, a few children, and anything else?
Yeah, all those things. And I once almost got into a nice pyramid scheme, but I didn't.
Okay. Well, we'll have to have that story come out. One of the things that we've talked about ahead of time, listeners, is there is sort of this culture, I think an article I read today, there's sort of almost like a Mormon culture and Utah culture as a petri dish, that are the ideal conditions for certain things to grow up, and affinity fraud is one of the pieces that we'll at least have as part of our discussion today. So thanks, Stephen, for that, and welcome to the show. Anapesi Kali'i, I'm sure you're going to say it better than that. I think I'm kind of close.
That was close. I am Anapesi Kali'i, and I am a doctoral student at the University of Utah in Education, Culture, and Society. I also often teach the Pacific Islander History and Experience course through the Ethnic Studies Department at the University of Utah, run the Social Justice Scholars Program through our Honors College at the university, and have recently accepted a position as the new executive director for the Salt Lake Charter School, which is a charter school catered specifically to Pacific Islanders and, of course, all students, but with a specific focus on Pacific Islander community here in Utah.
Awesome. And your own background is you have a dual sort of citizenship in Tonga as well as the United States.
And yes, and like Steve, I also have nine in my family and was raised both here in Utah and in Tonga. So yeah, I have a dual citizenship of both Tonga and here in the United States.
Great. And you work don't you head up a youth program for Islander youth?
Yes, I am the director of one of the largest Pacific Islander international movement, youth liberation movement, which is called the HIGHT Movement, which stands for Helping Youth Pursue Emancipation.
Awesome. Yeah. Wow. We'd love to have you on before, so, and welcome back. And I'm going to throw the ball to you early on, if you don't mind. What we decided ahead of time is that we would talk a little bit about what it is, you know, Manti Te'o, as a person shaped by a culture, and in this case, Mormonism, as well as Islander culture and family organizations and different sorts of emphases and things like that. And he's a person that, depending on, you know, there's certainly some skeptics out there that feel like he was in on this whole thing and that there's no way that he could be as naive and sort of wide-eyed and just, you know, very pure as he comes across in many ways. And that was one of the strengths and one of the reasons he was such an interesting story all year. So there's people that don't do that, but clearly there is a level of naivete or a level of very trusting nature. And so, Anapesi, as we launch this early discussion about that general thing and what contributes to it, I wanted to make sure that we got the Islander Polynesian family kind of setup stuff. So if you don't mind at least launching us in this first area with some aspects of that that you think are worth bringing up in this storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to start out, first of all, by making it clear that I do not know Man Tai Te'o personally, nor do I know his family. So, and I needed to say that because a lot of times when I've been asked about this story, there's an assumption that all Pacific Islanders are related and we all somehow know each other or at least have run into each other
right.
in various occasions. And sometimes that may be true, but in this particular case, I do not know the family and I don't know him personally. So my analysis of it is just from my general experience in working within the Pacific Islander community, growing up as a Tongan female in the United States, and my research that I do, which is focused on second and third generation Pacific Islanders, meaning those who were born and raised here in the United States. And so a lot of what I bring to this story comes from that perspective. So I just wanted to give that context ahead of time. This is really an unfortunate story and one that is really a complex one, I would have to say. But I think if I was looking at it, not understanding the complexities and the context of how the Pacific Islander culture works within itself, I would see it completely as something that he was part of, this whole in putting this together. But my read of it from my own personal perspective is that there are a couple of different layers, I guess, that we can look at in relation to Man Tai. Number one, that he comes from a very small town, La'ie, in Hawaii, which is probably the most Mormon, I guess referred to as a Mormon town in Hawaii. And those who are Pacific Islanders are very familiar with it because most of us who live here in Utah or elsewhere throughout the United States somehow came through La'ie, as many of our grandparents and parents were brought up through La'ie as labor missionaries to help build the La'ie temple. And so there is a very strong sense of family that is there in La'ie. And having been there and also having family there, him coming from that place, a lot of times individuals who travel to Hawaii and go into La'ie have often said that La'ie is very different. And it's almost like a town that, you know, everybody pretty much knows each other. And it's been described as something that is not even, that is not part of Hawaii or something like that. But there's something about that town that's very secluded. It's very exclusive. Pretty much everyone knows each other. And so he born and raised in that place, traveling from there, you know, to Notre Dame and being in school there. But there's also a very strong foundation of family. And from what I understand, his relationship with Ranaya, who has been identified as the friend who started this whole hoax, is that Ranaya's family is also a very well-known family within the Pacific Islander culture. His father is a preacher in California. And so there was a certain kind of trust that another, and at least in the conversations that's been going on in the Pacific Islander community, that, you know, a lot of people have been saying that, you know, that they just, it's really difficult to believe that another Pacific Islander would do this to another Pacific Islander. And especially a Pacific Islander coming from the Tui Sasopo family, who also comes from a very well-known and trusted Pacific Islander families. And so even the Te'o family is also a family that's very revered, not only in Samoa, but also in Hawaii. So there is sort of that layer of the relationship, that the fact that he comes from a good family, that oftentimes because the foundation of the Pacific Islander cultures, our identity is all tied to that genealogical tie in families, that there is sort of a given trust, not necessarily because he knew Ranaya, but because of who Ranaya's family would be, or who he comes from, what family he comes from. And so a lot of times that there are some connections that are made on that level that leaves individuals vulnerable in a sense, because there are these relationships that's been made previous in the islands, that somehow there's an idea that these individuals could be trusted. And so And so I see a couple of things here in relation to this story. Manti kind of entering into this story as an individual who is a Pacific Islander, who is Mormon. And although Renaya, from what I understand, is not, comes from a family that also has a spiritual connection background as far as coming from a family of whose father is a pastor, a reverend, etc. And so I can see that certain things would kind of go unquestioned, even though certain parts of the story just doesn't make any sense. And at certain points you think, well, wouldn't you interject? Wouldn't parents interject? Wouldn't you question this more? But I do see that there, I can see how there could be a certain level of trust, that whether Renaya deserved that trust, that had more to do with the actual family that he came from rather than him himself. And so I see that. And then also another part of it is that Manti being put into this, I guess, within looking at the way in which Pacific Islanders have been represented in the media, have been very negative. And so you find very few representations of Pacific Islanders in the media that are positive. I think I can count all of them on both hands. And so a lot of the representations that's been out there have been very negative. And so to see one person be out there, which I feel is completely unfair to put such a burden on this individual, but to see him be out there in the mainstream media light before all of this came out, he served as this very positive representation for Pacific Islanders. And as for myself as Tongan and he as Samoan, he transcended that line of various different Pacific Islander cultures, because he was looked at as a Pacific Islander who was portraying this very positive representation that is often missed or omitted in the media. And so I can see in some ways where for himself, the pressure to maintain that even when finding out, you know, from what the record says in December 6th, he knew that this was a hoax. On December 8th, during the Heisman ceremony, he still continued with that story and never tried to disrupt the narrative. I can see how that can happen, because in many of the youth that I work with, I see this often happening, where they recognize that the disruption of the story is not only a reflection on them, but it is also a reflection on a family name and also a reflection on a larger group of people. And so I can see why in certain ways he continued on with this, you know, misperception, even when he did find out. And I can see that the same thing for the parents who later found out, you know, who also in some ways sort of continued with the same narrative without disrupting this narrative either. And I think so much of that has to do with the fact that we are a small community here in the United States. And when there is the fact that this came out about Manti Te'o, that in the media, it is about Manti Te'o, but every single Pacific Islander feels that and, you know, are being questioned about it. I all the time, you know, I mean, just since this has come out in the grocery store, at the university, at church, the question is questioned to me as if I can speak on behalf of Manti Te'o and his family, but only because, not that I have any connection to him, but the fact that we are Pacific Islander, there is an idea that you should be able to tell me about the mentality of what was happening with Manti Te'o and his family and why did he make these decisions. And that just goes to show how much his persona of who he is also connected to every other Pacific Islander out there, whether we choose to be part of the discussion or not.
Right. Thank you. And have you read the transcript with Jeremy Schopp from ESPN?
No, I haven't read the transcript. I've only heard different parts of the interview.
Okay. Well, there's some things at the end where it talks about the phone call on the 6th of December, and then the thing. And I don't know. I'll take the heat from whatever comments come. And again, at this point, however, paints a pretty compelling picture of still not knowing what the heck was going on. You know, he did have all these award season things to go through and things like that. But he, I don't know, he comes across pretty compelling to me about all the things why he just didn't at that, hey, I'm alive after all. And she starts telling the story of running from drug, you know, people and, you know, fearing for her life and all that stuff. And that's why she disappeared. It's pretty agonizing and interesting what he says. Anyway, he comes across pretty compelling to me that even up until, what's his name? The fellow who perpetuated the hoax.
Renaya.
Yeah, Renaya. It was on top of my head. Until he texted him on the 16th of January to apologize, he really still wasn't 100% convinced, which again adds to this level of how could you be this naive and so trusting. Did you have any more points to make on that? Because now let's start adding Mormon layers to this. Or Stephen or Jennifer, did you have any questions for Anna Pesce on anything that you've heard so far about Polynesian culture?
No questions, but it's very illuminating for me. It actually it helps me see the story in a different light for sure.
Yeah, I was completely ignorant of all that stuff.
And one of the things that even when his story first kind of broke out, I can't remember if it was ESPN or who it was that did the whole kind of short documentary on him about the Heisman. I was really, you know, I was really kind of sad that it didn't highlight most of the work that he's done, because he has done a lot of work in the community as far as among the youth. He's done a lot of volunteer work and just, you know, being out there and helping and talking to young people and so forth. But none of that was highlighted because it was all focused on this story about the girlfriend and also on the spiritual him. And I felt that plays into what we usually always hear as one of the biggest stereotypes about Pacific Islanders, is that they are hyper spiritual, you know, and that they are people, you know, if you look at any of the writings that's been out there about Pacific Islanders, that they're described as, you know, people with extremely profound faith, you know, they're extremely, extremely spiritual. And so when I watched that, I thought it was kind of unfortunate that they chose specifically to focus on that and, you know, just about his story of what happened with the grandmother and his and the so-called girlfriend at the time. And they really focus on that this is just this really spiritual kid. And I think that they were pushing probably the whole Mormon dialogue in that because of, you know, what just happened with the elections and so forth. But there was so much more to who he was as a person aside from that story. And I think that his story was actually, his story of who he is, regardless of the deaths that he experienced, is much more, to me, much more profound about the work that he's been doing, about going back, traveling, making a point to travel back to Hawaii consistently to be able to give back to his high school that he went to school at, to go back to places like Haula and other places that are often ignored in Hawaii, where they have a very, very high poverty rate, places where Native Hawaiians are living that are often completely just disregarded, and the work that he's done there. But they chose not to look at that, and they specifically chose this particular narrative as the one that they wanted to highlight because they felt that that's what people would most identify with, at least in my opinion, that people would most identify with in regards to who he is.
Thank you. That's very good to have added in there. There is one piece of Islander family structure and cultural stuff that might be a good, you know, tie, or at least a segue into some Mormon things. And isn't there a high regard for elders and authority figures and your parents? And there's family structures that kind of lead to respect and not questioning, perhaps?
There is definitely a hierarchy within the family setting, and there is a very high respect for elders within the Pacific Island culture, and that's pretty pan-Pacific. You know, you can see it throughout all of the different islands, you know, and that there are responsibilities of various individuals who are in these of various individuals who are in the who are in these specific positions. And so, I mean, there are certain things that I could see, you know, with this that kind of, I see that thread playing through this where you see that respect for authority, you know, taken to the extreme, you know, in many sense. I mean, that was very clear to me when this came out about, you know, about what happened and Ronaya's position and role that he played in this, that there was kind of a backlash in the sense because Ronaya's father is a authority figure. He has a high position in one of the Samoan churches. And so the Pacific Islander community was torn in many ways because it was two Pacific Islanders who were out there in the media that were being discussed, where one, you know, was put as a victim and the other one was the person who was perpetuating this, you know, whole story. And a lot of people didn't want to come out and speak against that because Ronaya's father holds a high position in the church. And from what I understand, even Manti's family were very careful about the way in which they went about to point out who was actually behind this in respect for the elders in the other family, in Ranaya's family, even though Absolutely. The evidence sort of shows that clearly, you know, this happened. And from what I understand, there was then some questions from others where, because you guys are treading lightly and not naming him as the person who did it, that must mean that Manti had a part to do with it, which is why you're not stating that publicly, you know, to the public, that this was something that was done by this young man to Manti. But that wasn't really the reason why. The reason, it goes farther than that. It has to do with grandparents and great-grandparents and connections back in the islands. And so how they chose, you know, of course, the media took hold of the story, and then it was kind of out of their hands how that story was going to go. But on the ground level within the community, there is still the conversations that are happening there is the two families themselves are still trying to figure out how do they have this conversation about what has happened to these two individuals. Right, so there are a lot of other dynamics that go into there that could be read as a hesitation on Manti's part and Manti's family to come out and clearly, you know, give us all of the text messages, give us all of the, you know, emails, everything that you have so that we can, because everyone wants to be able to say, okay, this is the reason why it happened and this is the individual that was behind it, but it's actually much more complex than that when you look at it from a cultural perspective, because these are not just random families who don't have any other kind of connections to each other ever. And these aren't random families that are not going to somehow see each other, you know? And so even though this happened with these two individuals, the layers are much deeper than that as far as the conversations behind that as to why this happened and how do we heal from this actual situation.
Yes, thank you very much. That's excellent to have that other layer there too. And I'm not so sure how much authority and respect and things like that plays into this particular case, in the sense that there wasn't really any spiritual advisor in Manti's, you know, thing, Manti's story. Certainly he respected his parents and his father, and there is one piece of his father telling the story of how he had met Lene. Lene is the name of the girlfriend, the woman that he had had the relationship with, you know, that turned out to be a false persona. There was a piece of it where he went to meet her and he was like 20 minutes away and they somehow couldn't get there. And of course, when it's a hoax, everybody works against it doing it, but he didn't want to tell his dad that he didn't actually meet with her. So that's when he first kind of told what he claims as the first false thing that he ever said, was that he did meet her. So then you later get his father getting interviewed at times throughout the season and kind of referring to this meeting back in Hawaii and things like that that didn't happen. So there is that a little bit of element. But one of the interesting things that came out today, I don't know if you guys saw it, was his bishop in South Bend, Indiana, would often come over to Manti's apartment, and Manti would be on the phone with Lene, and he would talk to Lene And so here's this other layer that you could possibly say of, you know, this bishop didn't get any red flags, and if he has the spirit of discernment and mantis a member of his flock, that would just be that little minor extra layer of, you know, my guard's down in terms of any mistrust of this woman, because here's my bishop who converses with her.
And apparently they share scriptures with each other.
Yes.
There was kind of discussions being taught through
messaging. Yeah, Manti's parents joined their little group.
Just how things could get complicated in the sense that, because I think that the mother, their interview that's forthcoming, that's supposed to be this Thursday with Katie Couric, they've mentioned that the mother talks about how they were hoping that she would eventually get baptized. They had been sharing scriptures with her. And, you know, and so there's that piece of it, too.
Right. So whoever's the woman portraying Lene, definitely was persuasive, and the scripture sharing thing. Apparently, both parents were part of this little morning thing where you took turns and you presented the scripture, and they called it SOAP, which stood for scripture. Looking for it here in my big transcript. This is scripture observation, application, and prayer. They pick out a picture scripture one day that we talk about our observations on it, how it applied to our lives. Then we'd say a prayer, helping us apply that scripture and what its teaching is for our lives, and we do that every day. And then it talks about how if somebody would fall down, the dad would say, whose turn is it? Who isn't put the scripture up today? So there was this pretty elaborate thing going on here. And the big piece of it was, he says, the reason he fell for this girl and the reason he was able to say, you know, at some point in April of this year. So there's really only a four-month period that he claims that they had kind of had off and on Facebook contact through several years, but it was only in April, and it was her spirituality and those pieces of her that led him to feel that she really was his girlfriend, that he was willing to commit to her with his heart. Jennifer or Stephen, what is it in Mormonism that, I'll just start with you, Jennifer, to pick one at random, what pieces of Mormon culture and Mormon group life or whatever do you feel also at play in here on top of the layers of the Polynesian family structure?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a little hard to speak to Manti Te'o's specific situation, but I would say, you know, if we're thinking kind of about gullibility in among Mormons in general, you know, perhaps a piece is that we believe or we want to believe very much in a just universe, or in the sense that if we do the right thing, that God will bless our lives. And so, you know, among my clients, and just as in my experience growing up in the church, there's often this sense that, you know, we're kind of looking for that place where we will be blessed or cared for, or that, you know, good thing will come into our lives. And so, you know, I don't know how much that kind of sets us up in some ways to not be critical in our judgments and to sort of accept something as potentially a blessing, or to commit to something or invest in something without the same level of scrutiny that we might have if we didn't believe that God might be behind it offering something good into our lives. Thinking a little bit more about some of the kind of the fraud that often happens in Utah, and that sometimes we link blessings to financial well-being as well. And so some of that is being in the form of blessings, that if I join this, you know, if I invest my money with this person, this is a way that I may be blessed.
Oh, both of those are big pieces.
Yeah, actually, I think that a lot of what Jennifer is talking about, I like to blame that sort of thing on Nephi. This is why. First of all, he's, I would argue, the most popular character in the Book of Mormon, and he's also the person who is talked about the most, because everybody starts at the beginning of the Book of Mormon, and Nephi has, you know, an interesting story to tell, and he tells it well. But the interesting thing about Nephi is that he was very sure about everything, and when he wasn't sure, an angel would come by and make him sure. So, for example, you know, should I lop off Laban's head? The spirit comes by and says, yes, absolutely. And then Nephi says, gee, how do I build a ship? The spirit comes by and it says, well, here's how you build a ship. And this is an interesting role model for people to look at, because whenever Nephi goes into these situations that he has no expertise in, you know, go in and get the golden plates or get and get the plates of brass from Laban, he explicitly says, I went and did it knowing not what I would do, right? And then he goes off and he builds a ship, having, you know, lived in Jerusalem his entire life. He builds a trans-Pacific ship, or whichever way he went. And so we have this role model who's constantly going into these situations where he has no expertise, and God is behind it, and so it gets pushed along in the right sort of way, and Nephi always ends up pretty well off. And so maybe that has sort of really sunk deep into the Mormon psyche. We say, you know what righteousness looks like? It looks like Nephi. God prepares the way for you, even though you don't know what you're getting into. Or in other words, faith it till you make it. That was a joke.
Yeah, no, I got it. Okay,
dang,
sorry. Sorry. I had to get to, I had to reach for my mute button to get off mute.
I think one of the things I want to add to that, that sort of an example of what you're saying in regards to the Manti situation, there was something that he said in the interview that in one of the interviews that really stood out to me, where he was asked after the game about this girlfriend that had passed away and that he knew he had never met her, but portrayed as if he did meet her. And so, you know, that's where he, where it kind of like where he knew that it was wrong to continue to talk about her as if he met her when he knew he never met her, but he felt that he, how many people could benefit from this story, and that maybe they would read it in a completely different way and be inspired by it, you know, and would lead them to make positive decisions. I don't know. Yeah. I'm kind of
overcome
just,
their own
adding
adversity.
Certain things
yeah.
to, that's not what he said, but the fact that he knew it was, he knew he had never met the girl, but he tried to portray in that particular game where they played and he played really well and he won and everyone wore leis to that game as to honor him because of these two individuals that he lost in his life. And in the interview following right after that game, he gave the perception that he had met her, that they had this really, you know, close relationship, and he was uneasy about it. He voiced in the opinion that he was uneasy about it, but he did it anyways because he felt that maybe someone could benefit from this story, even though he was withholding just part of it in the sense that he never met her, you know? And so I see that he was conflicted with it, but still went forward with it for the greater good, I guess, you know, in some way, like that actually, yeah, I'm withholding this part, but look at all these people who are inspired by this story, that somehow that makes it all right that I withheld this particular part from that actual story.
John Ford, a great director, he's been quoted to say, when forced to pick between fact and legend, print the legend.
Right.
Right, and the legend is what people respond to, right?
Oh, it's totally true. I mean, that's what people feed off of. We think that we like to interact with reality, but what we really do is interact with stories.
I think there's a strong element of this, of course, in the church where, you know, we know what the dominant narrative is, and we know what... I remember as a child bearing my first testimony, and I really knew what I believe the group wanted to hear from me was my faith, my confidence in the truthfulness of the church. You know, even I was 8 or 9 years old and I remember tearing up, probably mostly because of anxiety and nerves, but I also knew that was a part of the narrative, was to kind of demonstrate my belief through my tearfulness. And I mean, I wasn't faking it. I wasn't up there like, you know, consciously trying to misrepresent myself by any stretch, but that it's easy to kind of shape our experience into the narrative that we know is accepted, and to let go of data or information or bits of information that are incongruent with that narrative. And I think that, you know, that is very much that we do that because we believe it's for the good of the group, that it promotes the belief for all of us, and that it feels noble in a sense, even if you're letting go of information that's incongruent or inconsistent with it.
Cool. I want to get into all that because we can talk about Paul Dunn and we can talk about living up to it and things like that. But I didn't want us to leave naivete and trustingness and things like that. And I definitely don't want to leave Stephen's really wonderful point about the Nephi narrative and all that, because there's a couple of pieces of that that I think really are part of this. For instance, one of the things that Mormons will have picked up on, who had followed his career and what led him to Notre Dame to begin with, was his absolute, putting it almost in typical Mormon testimony terms, mm-hmm. I didn't know where to go. I had all these offers, including going to the Mormon school, you know, which would have been fine. You know, that was obviously the one that you'd think that the Lord would say. But the Lord basically made it clear to him that he was to go to Notre Dame, and he was to be this Mormon among the Catholics, and, you know, and to do all that. And so he definitely, within the narrative structure of, I don't know what to do, and I got a clear manifestation from God. I don't think he ever claimed angels like Nephi there, Stephen, in your story, but there was clearly that piece. And then the second thing was related to stuff that you were saying, Anapesi, when he didn't correct the record, and you kept saying he didn't meet. We got to be clear, he'd never met her in person, but he interacted with her left and right. I mean, daily phone calls. Apparently, she would claim that she couldn't go to sleep at night unless he was on the phone with her, and so he would go to sleep talking to her, and she would go to sleep, and in the morning they would I guess say some kind of prayer together, and the phone bills all show these 8-9 hour phone calls where this was this. So he was constantly with her and things like this. But here's what he said when it came to motivation on the playing field, because they said, you know, this was a magical season for it. And how much did her death, you know, you thinking that she died, fed into it? And in the interview with Jeremy Schaap of ESPN, he says, well, it just helped me because my spiritual growth at the time, you know, I was always taught that the Lord doesn't put you through things that he knows that you can't handle. So we've got, I mean, 1 Nephi 3:7 there. So as bad as it was, now that I know that, if I just have faith and if I did the right things, everything would work out. So my spiritual life was at a peak at that time, so it helped. Her death, I'm not saying that it's a good thing, but it motivated me to say that my spiritual life was at its best. So in other words, for him, this was a very spiritual thing, wrestling with her death and knowing and feeding into these narratives that we've already talked about here. So again, there was a ready-made storyline, a ready-made framing that made trusting her quite easy, as well as some of the other things where he didn't stop that train once it got started. What else in Mormon culture? Let's you mentioned the affinity fraud, Jennifer. What is it that you have picked up or gleaned about Mormon trustingness and face-to-face kind of friendship things and being gullible?
Yeah, well, I found a couple of articles online that were, I think, printed last winter or spring, and in Utah, talking about the particular vulnerability in Utah for what they call affinity fraud, and that is literally people going in and taking advantage, or, you know, people taking advantage of their association and the trust, the inherent trust that develops within groups and communities, to exploit it. And that this is a particularly large problem among members of the church, as it is among any kind of close-knit group.
Yeah, lots of talk about Bernie Madoff being successful among Jews,
yes,
fellow Jews.
That's exactly right.
Things like that. Yeah.
So, you know, it's, I think, well, I have my thoughts about kind of how it happens, but it is a particularly big problem, and it's been an especially big problem in Utah as we've been in this economic downturn, that as people have been struggling more financially and, in my opinion, perhaps looking more for answers or looking for blessings and then being more willing to trust someone in their ward or someone that's, you know, in their community who's suggesting, you know, if you invest with me, you'll get 150% on your money in a year or whatever, and being willing to go against sort of their better judgment to trust in those connections. And so I know the church, there was a conference that the church participated in which it, you know, sent a representative, and then there was actually a publication by the church where they were encouraging members or discouraging members from, you know, not using their best judgment in making these decisions. And so apparently it's been a big problem, but I think one that happens in groups where, you know, I do think it's a functional part of communities to be able to trust one another, that's a good thing that happens. But oftentimes then, of course, that trust can be exploited, and we may let go of our better judgment or our scrutiny because we just want to trust the people around us, and therefore we can be taken advantage of.
Plus, there's these external things, though, like you see somebody and you see the garment line under their clothes. Right. You know, that's an unspoken thing. Or you know you've attended the temple with them. Or you see how they, you know, seem to have the perfect idyllic Mormon family or whatnot. And so all these different things that help you let down your thing. And my mom got bilked out of $25,000 in the late 90s from a Latter-day Saint. And so she and my sister and brother-in-law all testified at his excommunication and things like that. But it definitely happens and easy. Now, Stephen, you recently shared with me an article or an essay that's coming out in Sunstone that actually added it's not necessarily fraudulent so much as it took advantage of another aspect of Mormon culture, which is missionaries and you know, the idea of setting let me just have you tell it as well as any of that story that you almost shared about almost getting bilked yourself.
Well, yeah, the article is by Jacob Bender, and he recounts the time he spent in Colorado installing alarm systems, and he says that the majority of the force of the sales force was Mormon, and that whenever they had their little pep talk meetings, they reminded him of zone conferences, and he would see these young lads just off their missions go out and use the same approaches that they had used in the mission field on these on people to sell them these alarm systems, which usually were not worth the money that it was getting paid for. But the really interesting thing about the article is him kind of digging underneath the surface and saying, why is it that the Mormon kids were so drawn to this, and why were they, you know, relatively successful and so driven? And the thing he comes up with is that these days there really isn't like an ordinance that happens a lot that makes your calling an election made sure. That's kind of like a thing of the past. And so Mormons are kind of left, you know, wondering, have I made it? You know, am I saved type of thing? How do you know when you're a Mormon that you've made it? And there are really only two things that would probably strike the average Mormon as saying, you've made it, you are chosen, you're going to get to the celestial kingdom. One of those things is becoming a general authority. Because, you know, once you're there, and once you've got the suit on, and once you have that mugshot for the ensign, you're in. but since there's only a limited number of people who can be in that position, and since they have to kind of be male, then the only other way that you can really find out, you know, really have tangible evidence that you're going to the celestial kingdom is if you're righteous, then you will prosper in the land. That's what the Book of Mormon says a number of times, though it says other things elsewhere. And so he feels like prospering in the land, in other words, making money, is God's divine way of telling you, good job, buddy, your righteousness has made it. And so I kind of imagine some of these people who get taken in by affinity fraud, kind of it's they're saying to themselves, this might prove my righteousness. If indeed I have been righteous enough to attract this possibility of 150% return, then that means that I've made it to the celestial kingdom. And when this money comes in, I'll know.
Yeah, I'll know God's approval. Yeah, yeah, and Bender frames it all in Max Weber's famous right. thesis of the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, which again it deals with predestination and not knowing your status, you know, because it's inscrutable and it's purely God's act. But yet, many people they thought that the capitalism flourished in that sense of if I work hard and do this, that might be an indication of God's favor, and I'll at least have a hint that I'm right. that I'm approved and not bound for hell.
Yeah, and couldn't it also be in some ways a function of our narcissism? I mean, in the sense that, and this is obviously not what Christ taught us to be, but you know, that we can sort of get caught up in that we're in the true church and we've got the right answers, and in some ways, like, of course God is going to bless me financially. Of course, you know, like, almost like you want to believe that you are this special person, and so you are sort of less willing to see the risk that's inherent to the choice you're making and very willing to focus on the possibility because of this kind of belief in your specialness, I think.
Totally.
I mean, can I just share when I was growing up, my parents were in Amway and my dad was the stake president. And of course, you were in the true church and all that. And my sister, who was 8 years old at the time, shared with me, you know, as she got older, that she remembered thinking, like, how could we be so special? Like, we're in the true church, the true business, using that, like, the true soap. And kind of like it just fed this sense of, like, we're such a special family. And I don't know, I just think that was a tenor a little bit in some of my family upbringing and religious sure. thinking.
And not exclusive yeah. to Mormon, but definitely these lines are within Mormonism for sure.
I actually wonder if there isn't one more layer to this. I think that a lot of kind of born in the covenant Mormons have convert and envy. They really want to know what it's like to be converted, but the problem is they get whisked into the water, you know, when they're 8 years old, and they never really get that chance to go through kind of that hero's journey into the light and coming in into the truth. And so when somebody comes along with this new beautiful idea, you know, this new supplement or this new political philosophy or this new money-making opportunity, they probably start to feel like, oh my gosh, this is what conversion feels like. There is a truth that I have been unaware of up until now that will free me and empower me in many important ways, and all the endorphins get going and they get really giddy because they're on the path to a conversion. And I also think that we're predisposed to think that this kind of truth could come knocking on our door, you know, literally with a tie, because so many of us spent 2 years literally knocking on doors with the truth. And so it doesn't strike us as at all strange that somebody could come to us in a tie with the truth and that we could be converted and it would be wonderful.
Wow, that's terrific. What did you guys think of that? That was cool, I thought. The affinity fraud stuff is absolutely a piece of it. Anapassi, we haven't had you anything on that particular thing. I still want to stay a little bit longer in trustingness and whatnot, but did you have anything where we're at right now?
No, just I clearly, you know, see the parallels between the two, and especially within Pacific Islander communities, where there is, as I mentioned in the beginning, a certain trust of individuals who you think share the same kind of shared history and experiences that you do, particularly because they're from that community. And a lot of time there is you immediately trust them and you don't question too much their intentions, because there is an idea there that you both share the same, you know, kind of experiences. And I see that a lot within the Pacific Islander community, but especially as an immigrant community. I mean, I can say that there are a lot of individuals that I interact with on a daily basis that if we all grew up together in the islands, I probably would have never interacted with them. But the fact that we are here in the United States in a small community forces us to reach out to each other to be able to nurture and sustain our experiences as immigrant groups to the United States. And so I find myself doing that. And so on top of that, so not only do you have that layer, but on top of that, you have the Mormon layer. So if you are Mormon and Pacific Islander, the trust goes up even double,
right.
You know, because not only is this a Pacific Islander, but it's also a Mormon. And so you kind of have this, okay, we must completely share the same experiences. And so, you know, you understand where I'm coming from and I understand where you're coming from. And I mean, it happens to me all the time. I'll be traveling to Chicago or elsewhere and I'll see someone who I can see is Pacific Islander, and I'll go up and introduce myself to them, and then we'll start talking and become great friends when we've never met each other before, but solely on the fact that we both come from the islands. And it's sort of a crazy idea when you sit back and think about it, but a lot of that is sort of the experience of many immigrant groups who do come to the United States, who are a smaller group and who are oftentimes not, well, especially with the Pacific Islander group, but they're referred to as the invisible minority in the United States. And so there's this sort of wanting to get to know every single person, and there is a certain kind of trust that's there. So I do see the parallels and the connections, and then being Mormon on top of that also adds on to that whole relationship.
Yeah.
And I have a couple thoughts, Dan. One is I was watching a 60 Minutes episode about 2 months ago where they were showing the research they've done on babies. And it really was showing that we're kind of hardwired to do this, to kind of create an in-group and an outside group. And they presented the babies with two different options of snacks. And so let's say they chose the Fruit Loops. Well, the puppet that would also choose the Fruit Loops, then the baby would immediately favor that puppet that wanted the same thing. And then not only would they favor the puppet that liked the Fruit Loops, they would actually be comfortable with the other puppet that chose the other snack being punished. You know, I mean, and so it's a little hard to explain without seeing how this was played out. But it was really interesting to see how these babies would already be kind of looking for who's sort of my inside group, who's the group that's like me that I can trust. And so I thought that was interesting. The other thought I had is that, you know, for me as a therapist, it's always easy to like vilify the parents of my client or the person that's not in the room for their behavior, like to see them as capable of doing mean things, to see that outsider, the person I haven't met, as capable of being cruel. But the person sitting in front of me, I have a strong inclination to trust them or to see them as well-intentioned, to see them as a good person, even if they do unkind things sometimes. And I think that that's just that affinity experience, that once I sort of see you and I'm sitting with you, I want to trust you. I want to believe you're a good person, whether or not you are. And so I often have to kind of work with myself to let myself see what is really there rather than what I want to see.
Terrific. Before we leave naivete, trustingness, and all that stuff, let's add another Mormon possibility or something that at least comes in religion. As many of us know, this thing called faith means there's no proof. There's, you know, you're taking a leap. You're moving beyond rationality to sort of vote with your heart in some sort of ways. And what do you guys think? Is the Mormon story, which is so, you know, it's one thing when you have a God 2,000 years ago resurrecting and a religion that comes with that, and you've had all these centuries of belief and things like that. So that the edge is taken off of that, the spectacular nature of those kinds of claims. But there you have just, you know, 200 years ago in upstate New York, you know, angels and God visiting. And Mormonism basically requires a pretty good leap of faith that says, I'm willing to believe something that most people would look at and go, "What the heck are you talking about there? This, you guys don't have your skeptical blinders on for this." Do you think that's a piece in Manti Te'o's trusting nature, or, you know, again, I can't really say this a piece for affinity fraud. I think we've already kind of caught the main threads on that, but. Anna Pessy, maybe ask you to start a little bit about, is there anything about the Mormon claims themselves that you think might be a piece of, you know, this staggering, what appears to outsiders as the staggering naivete?
Yeah, I do. I do believe that there is a piece of that. And I think, as I mentioned in the beginning, there's also a piece within Pacific Islander culture that we are hyper-spiritual. And that is something that is reinforced consistently in our communities. You know, I hear it all the time, you know, just have faith and that comes out in everything, you know, that is being done. And one of the examples of that is during when I would go out and we would work on getting people to individuals in our community or community members to be political, you know, to go out and to speak out politically, to engage in protests, etc. One of the things that's consistently told to me by Mormon Pacific Islander communities is that we don't need to do that. The only thing that we need to do is to have faith and the Lord will deliver us to where we need to be. And mm-hmm. we don't need to be politically involved. We don't need to be engaged in that. We just need to live righteously. And so I think that in the case of, also one of the things that's consistently said is that we as Pacific Islanders who are looked at as the hyper-spiritual communities, that is our responsibility. That is our job to show the rest of the Mormon community, the larger Mormon community, that this is sort of our responsibility is to hold the faith, to be the faithful ones, to be the ones who have enduring faith and have faith to a much higher degree than anyone else, because that is who we are and as a people. And so I can see in many ways where with Manti, that this could be something where he felt that he was doing what he was supposed to do. He had faith that this will work out. And, you know, he never met the girl, but he, in good faith, he's sharing the scriptures with her. He's reading with her. He's bearing his testimony to her, you know, whatever the experiences are. And that if he just remains faithful and continues to be the spiritual giant that he's often referred to in these documentaries, that everything will be fine. And that's a narrative that I'm very familiar with and hear it consistently all the time, more so within the Mormon Pacific Islander community, but also even when I go to other communities and that are not Mormon but are Pacific Islanders, this whole thread of spirituality is consistently, you know, projected upon us. And even when general authorities have come to the islands and have spoken in the islands, that is what is always said. You know, you are a people of profound faith. You know, you're the people from the islands of the sea, you know, that's been that has been spoken about in the Book of Mormon. You know, you bring this faith that no other group of people have. And that's a lot of, you know, and that plays into the whole psyche, especially of those of us who born and raised LDS, that not only am I LDS, but I'm a Pacific Islander LDS, which means that I'm actually have this affinity to be much more spiritual than others because it is part of my DNA, part of my being. And that's a narrative that is consistently being projected and shared and embraced by so many individuals in our community.
Wonderful. Jennifer, Stephen, anything else about the Mormon belief system? And again, I'm just trying to get towards an understanding for outsiders who might wonder about how could anybody be this guileless to be taken in by this?
I think that in my experience that while I would say that having a sense of the rational and the spiritual that are intertwined has been probably the most fruitful in my life personally, that I do think there is a kind of elevation of the story. I think much like Stephen was talking about in First Nephi, is this idea that the suppression of logic actually is what often facilitates and allows us to come to know God or to come to know God's will. And so, you know, often it's the stories of like where, you know, I had this inspiration to do this crazy, you know, this thing that would seem completely illogical and would make no sense, but I was impressed to do it. And then I had the faith to go do this thing. And then this amazing thing happened because I followed that. And I think sometimes those are the stories that we celebrate the most in the church, because it sort of shows that we're that in tune with the spiritual, we're that in tune that we're willing to let go of the kind of more rational part of ourselves. And while I would never say that that doesn't ever happen by any stretch, that the elevation of that way of getting revelation maybe makes us more vulnerable to put logic and scrutiny aside.
Yeah, and there's also the fact that since we have a lay ministry, and since, you know, we're always getting up to bear a testimony or give a talk or give a lesson or contribute to a lesson from the audience, we're constantly in need of this flow of stories that sort of typify the virtue that's being talked about. I mean, just last week, I was at priesthood meeting, and we got to the end, and the guy who was teaching said, "Well, this doesn't have a lot to do with what we're talking about. It's not a very interesting story, but," and he went on to tell this not very interesting story that had a little bit to do with what we'd been talking about. But where I was looking for something to say, I think we feel this gap of need, and we want to be able to stand up and say something that's really interesting, right? It would make us feel like we'd sort of arrived. I mean, when I was like my first month of my mission, we were out tracting, and I was being kind of dreamy and non-responsive, and my companion looked at me and said, "What, are you writing your homecoming talk already?" And I looked up, surprised, because that was what I was doing.
Oh, wow.
I was, and I realized, I mean, I just started my mission. What in the world would I be thinking? And I realized later when I started reflecting on it was that I was kind of gathering together all of the stories that I had ever heard from missionaries in their homecomings and starting to sort of impress them on my experiences. And I knew that I was at the beginning, and so I was saying, you know, I need to look for the beginnings of these stories so that I have them to tell when I get back. Because if you come back as a returned missionary and you don't have these stories to tell, you know, what kind of missionary were you?
Right.
Terrific. Wow. So good.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.